It was the year of deep geeking.
The year of Feedbackapalooza.
The year we discussed our favorite show.
It was the year without Zima.
The year of great tequila.
The year of puns.
And a year of more interviews.
It was a new chance for fun.
It was the end of the series.
It was the year we made it to Crusade.
The year is 2009. The show, Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I am Tim Callender.
And how about that part one?
How about that part one? You know, if you haven't listened to part one, what's wrong with you people? what was amongst the other things we talked about that I thought was very interesting in part one was the pre-production stories about shopping the show around and JMS's different perceptions of what Paramount might have brought to the party versus what Warner's had, and vice versa. So that was something I don't think we've ever read in any other venue. I don't know that Joe's touched on it quite in depth like he did with us.
Yeah, and the stories about the different Warner Brothers divisions basically cannibalizing each other. I'd heard some of that before in previous years from Jeffrey, actually. But just hearing how much infighting there truly was, it boggles me. It really makes no sense that AOL would buy that company. And it should not be a surprise to anybody that AOL couldn't merge with
us. Yeah, right.
I mean, right. Holy cow.
It's one of those things that, and Joey even touches on this. So its weakness was also its strength for the show and vice versa. The fact of the matter was, could you have seen Paramount keeping hands off and just saying, yeah, okay, you guys go make your show?
Yeah, the creative freedom part was definitely a bonus for the production staff and us as fans.
Right.
Because we got to see the story as it was intended, not with, hey, can you have space bikinis in space or right. something.
There aren't enough cute robots.
Yeah, so the
beady, beady, beady.
Yeah, the in retrospect, in the greater the bigger picture of what we have to enjoy, having hands off the story is, I don't know if that's a anything you could top in terms of a bonus in working with Warners.
No, because ultimately that's the thing that appeals to us about Babylon 5. As frustrated as we get with everything else in terms of where the franchise, I'll say it, where the franchise is today, the fact is that if Joe hadn't been given that kind of creative freedom, we wouldn't have had the show that we have now that we so deeply love.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the long and the short of it. So,
yes, and getting
yep.
There's so much to go into.
So listen to the interview and then listen to part two, which is coming up, and send us your feedback. But we get ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, so we're going to bring you right back in to part two right after this.
You know, sometimes when you're looking for something just a little bit more refreshing, you've got to turn to Slice of Sci-Fi.
SliceofSci-Fi.com.
Babcom link established.
So, go ahead, Summer.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, speaking of River of Souls, why didn't the manuscript for the novel ever make it to publication? Was there something in it that just didn't resonate with you? Did it not hit the right notes that you had hit in the movie? What happened there?
in the broadest of terms, when one is given, anyone, any writer, is given the task of adapting a script to a novel, you want to add stuff to it. You want to make it more textured, more layered, and really build out from there. Make it a literary piece on its own terms. And that was the goal with all the B5 books, was that they shouldn't be just throwaways. They should be good books on their own terms. I mean, the Cyclone novels hold up whether you knew about B5 or not. Again, just as novels, I think they hold up pretty well. Same with the Technomage trilogy. And the manuscript, I thought, didn't really achieve what I wanted to achieve in that respect. And it would have had to have been completely redone. And that did not seem a viable option for us. So in the end, we let it go. I would rather have something not come out than not be what it needs to be, in my view.
Okay, well, you know, given how a lot of the fans really, really appreciate a lot of the novels, what do you think about how some of these novels are not in print anymore?
Yeah, it goes back to Warner's and to the fact that the show is not currently on the air. There's not that desire to sustain things. It's really been a huge drawback to the lifelong viability of Babylon 5 that it's not on the air. And publishers look at something and say, okay, where's the audience? You know, and even when Star Trek was out in production as a series before and after, the show was still out there. It could be easily seen. And there was no real push at Warner's Publishing to keep the books in print because of the fact, again, that there wasn't, they could put 10 hours into doing this or put 10 hours into something that will raise them a whole lot of money. So that was kind of allowed to die on the vine.
So what can we as fans do to convince Warner Brothers to let these rights go since they're not going to do anything with them?
They won't let them go.
Oh, but
what Warner's owns, Warner's owns. You could, firebomb the joint and they wouldn't let it go. Studios are not in the business of letting things go. They would rather make, 100% of nothing of nothing than 50% of something, provided they owned it. So the answer to your question is there ain't nothing. There's ain't. The only thing that would change the shape of the universe would be if there was to be another B5 series, not a one-off, but a series or a feature film. One particular that cost a good chunk of money, because one thing that all studios have in common is that their support for a project is determined in large measure by what it costs. So if something costs $2 million, say, to make, and publicity would cost $2 million, what's the point? But if something costs $100 million, then you're willing to spend $30 million in publicity because you'll get it back. But throwing money after something that's low budget doesn't profit you anything, which is why I've kind of drawn a line in the sand to say, amongst other reasons, that if Warner's wants to do anything else in the B5 universe, it has to, in a town that evaluates respect by money, it has to be a project where there is sufficient budget there to do something proper, something substantial, something worthy of the fans, something that I know will be backed up by marketing and advertising, which they tend not to do if it's too small of a budget. And Warner's, in a lot of studios, their attitude these days is, if it's less than $35 million, it's actually below their radar screens.
Wow.
It's not worth their time. They've actually said that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, your statement about that, about big budget or nothing, really generated a firestorm of outrage. So what was your reaction to all that reaction?
I don't want to say I don't care, because it's not true. But I also know that what is owed to the fans is not slipshod B5. It is not to throw something out there to get some money back. I come at this from being a fan myself. And one thing that always ticked me off as a fan was when I felt I was being exploited. And I don't want to do that. If the fans are willing to come out to, you know, spend X number of dollars on something DeFi related, I want them to get their money's worth. And to me, doing a DVD that costs $2 or $3 million, and that was all it cost, $2 or $3 million, you can't do what you want to do from a storytelling point of view. We couldn't afford extras. We couldn't afford sets. We couldn't afford effects. You know, and I look at it now, and it's an okay story. Sure, I mean, I won't say that I'm incapable of telling a bad story because I have enough proof to the contrary. That I can tell some really wretched stories when I want to. But
okay,
I also know that I'm reasonably good at what I do. But I can't go to the extreme that I want to go to tell a proper story if the support mechanisms aren't there in terms of budget, production, casting, effects, and so on. Then what you get is, you know, 2 hours of two characters sitting in a room talking. I'll make the dialogue as good as I can, but it's still two people sitting in a room talking for an hour.
Yeah, but it was really good characters saying really good things.
Thank you. Nonetheless, B5 as a series would not have worked with that approach.
Yeah, that's true.
The series was about more than that. And
well, it also struck a good balance. You know, you'd have episodes like The Coming of Shadows, mm-hmm. balanced out by Comes the Inquisitor.
Exactly. And one at a time, low-budget DVDs, you can't have that balance.
Sure.
You're stuck being static. You can't break out like it would in The Severed Dreams, you know, or Coming of Shadows. So you're hamstrung. And it's also, to me, a matter of respect. Because, again, studios equate respect with money. And I made it very clear to Warners, I'm not doing any more of these. When you're ready to give this show and its fan base the proper respect, as evidenced by a proper budget and proper advertising, then I'll do it. But not until then. I will not diminish the legacy of B5. I will not exploit the fans by keeping this stuff out there. I did the first B5 DVD because they said, if you do this, we'll give you more money for more, and there'll be a proper production. Well, that wasn't going to be the case. They, you know, the home video department had a feud with the DVD department, and all of a sudden they said, well, no, there'll only be $2 million from now on. Well, then no. Absolutely not. The show is too important to me to want to do it badly. I can make my corner of it, the writing, as good as I can, but I can't change the rest of it. You know, I can paint the walls of the house as pretty as I want to. If the structure and the architecture isn't solid, it's still going to be, you know, a slipshod place to live in. And I'm in a place now in my career where I think that I can now start to make that happen. It was about, I think, 6 months ago or so. I got a call from a very high-ranking person at Warners to say, how much would you need to make a Babylon 5 movie? And I told them, and so let's get back to you. And it's certainly something that I think if I went to them now and said to them, okay, I'm ready to go, will you commit to X budget and creative freedom, I think they would say yes. It's a matter, though, of my finding a story that I want to do, a story that's worth the doing, and getting the time to do it. I have been blessed at this point in my career to suddenly have a new career. Usually when, as a writer for television, you hit, you know, in your early 50s, you kind of start winding down. It's gone the opposite direction. My first act as a writer was a journalist. The second act was television. The third act now suddenly is features. And I'm working with astonishing people and doing some of the best work I've ever done. And it's now a matter of saying, okay, I have this cachet now and I can use it to create original projects. I can use it to revisit Babylon 5 and to get to the projects over here. I just recently optioned Robert Sheckley's book, Mind Swap, which I'm in the process of adapting to a script, which I'm very excited about. I'm a huge Sheckley fan. I want to bring up Midnight Nation. I'll bring up Dream Police. There are projects that I'm working on that I want to address. V5 is among them. And when I have a story that I realize that I have to tell, then I'll go back to Warner's and say, let's work this thing out. I don't know what that story is yet. I don't want to go in there and just come up with something. I want to have something that burns to be told. And when I have that, when I know what that story is, that I've got to get in there and tell, I'll make that call. And I have a suspicion, based on conversations I've had with Warner's, ever since suddenly I became a guy, ever since I became, you know, recognizable to the film division, that they would probably say yes.
So do you think it would be better for revitalizing the B5 franchise to do a feature film as opposed to another series?
I don't know, and I always get nervous when I talk about revitalizing the franchise, because I never looked at it as a franchise. I always go back to the mouth of the river, and when I set out to make B5, it was I want to tell this story over 5 years and walk away clean. And even in the height of seasons 2 and 3 and 4, I kept telling myself, come in, you tell the story, you tell the truth, and you walk away. And you don't turn it into a franchise. I know that that's counterintuitive to the way television works. And when I think of telling out the B5 story, I get excited. When I think about revitalizing the franchise, my hair stands on end. Not that you could tell, because it's diminished. but it does, because I try to think of it as a place and characters and a story that I care about, and not as a economic entity that needs to be revitalized.
I remember reading a quote from you many years back. It was response, I guess this is the merchandising, why don't we see action figures and that kind of stuff? And your comment at that point in time was that once you start with the merchandising, it hamstrings you in terms of storytelling, because now you've got to play toward the action figures as opposed to making the changes. So that's kind of... I think what I hear you saying from this is that you don't want to do it just to do it.
Exactly. The Hippocratic Oath, the first and foremost line is do no harm. And my sense is if you're going to do more stuff in the B5 universe, it should do no harm, particularly to the original. If it does not add to it, if it subtracts from it, then don't do it. If it can enhance what went before it, then consider it. I want to become one note also. I want to be, Gene Roddenberry, God love him, after Star Trek, that was pretty much it, you know. And I thought myself for a while that would be the case with B5, that, you know, when I croaked and rolled over and they planted me, you'd see in Variety, Greater Babylon 5. And to be, I was okay with that. But there was a part of me that said, I can do more. So I'm now in a position where I can do more and am doing more. But to me, that doesn't preclude B5. What it means is that I have an obligation to do only a good B5 if I can afford to wait until someone says, here's X number of dollars, go out and do it your way.
Okay. Now, looking at Star Wars with the expanded universe, which has got comics and novels and video games and all the rest, is that a possibility for expanding the Babylon 5 universe, for getting some of these tales out? Similar to what you did with the Technomage trilogy and the Psycor trilogy. Here's an outline, hand it over to a writer that you trust and flesh it out.
If there were publishers currently doing B5, yes. There aren't.
But that's still the Warner's thing that's getting in the way.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, do you think a next generation type TV show would work?
Sure.
Like a second generation of Babylon 5?
Yep. Pardon me. Yeah. look, there's literally a trunk of stories that I wanted to do and V5 didn't have time to do, which would apply to a new series as well as coming up with new stories I'd never even imagined at that time. The V5 universe is a good, solid foundation. And you could set a new series in there. You could do a remake of the original series. You could do a movie to reboot it. You could do a number of different things. And again, I don't want to come off cocky. I know that I can do wretched stories. But I think that were I to dip into that universe again, the new series, a new movie, whatever it is, it'd be cool. I wouldn't do it if I didn't think it would be cool.
Right.
But that is all a function of powers beyond my control.
So does Warner's or somebody else own television rights to future B5 Universe productions, or is that yet to be determined?
Warner's owns everything B5 except for the movie rights.
Everything?
Everything.
Oh, crap.
When you sell a TV show, they buy lock, stock, barrel, plus your next male child. There is no negotiating with that. And the only reason they gave me the movie rights was they thought they would be worth anything, which is my ace in the hole should I decide at some point to do a feature film. Because if Warner's were to say no, I could walk across the street to Paramount or any other studio and say, how would you like a franchise?
Right.
How does that affect the possibility of B5 stories in new media? Like audio dramas, radio plays, that sort of thing.
Warner's.
Crap.
Warner's owns it all.
So do we need to drop a negasphere on Warner's? Is that what you're getting at?
I don't want to portray Warner's as the bad guy. So the reality is these guys let me do my story model for 5 years. And that's saying something, particularly in the current climate, which you're seeing a lot more interference these days from the citizen networks and television shows. They left me alone, and, I love them for that, because most studios would not. I mean, Paramount, I knew many of the writers and producers who worked on Star Trek, and they would just bemoan the fact that they had to write with handcuffs on and mittens, because the studio was always watching over them to make sure that they didn't harm the franchise. We didn't have that problem. So, as much as one may become frustrated with the corporate structure of a studio, the fact is, they did right by me, and I cannot overmuch complain about them.
Do you have any frustration over the fact that because the different divisions of Warner's are trying to devour each other, that nothing fresh or new can come out of it in a more timely fashion?
I think stuff can. It's just a more elegant dance. the way that the business is built, getting anything of any real quality out there is difficult at best.
Mm-hmm.
As you're there to tell a story, they're there to make a profit. And there are areas where those two desires touch and areas where they do not. And it's not really show business, it's business show more than anything else. And you have to compete with those guys who look at it in those terms. So, yes, there can be fresh, original stuff done. I mean, look at Tudors. You look at a lot of the television that's being done. I mean, Dexter,
mm-hmm.
My God.
Yes.
My favorite shows. There is the irony is there's kind of more innovative television being done now, even with the overarching attention being paid to by the studios, than I've seen in a long time. I mean, King's, for all of its faults, and being canceled, unfortunately, is some innovative stuff. Yeah,
I thought that series should have gone on USA. Would have worked so much better on USA.
Yeah, I think so too. Deadwood, my gosh, I was enthralled by that show. So, granted, that's more on the pay cable than the broadcast, but the point remains that there is still the opportunity to do really good stuff. The problem we have on broadcast television was summed up for me by an executive at a network that will remain CBS. He said that we program for the people who can't afford to buy cable or satellite. That if you have a college education, good source of income, you're probably going to be putting it most of your time watching HBO or Showtime or Cinemax or whatever it is. Those who can't afford to buy those things or have that educational background to afford them, that's our audience. And make sure antennas go up when you hear that.
So does that change who you pitch shows to?
You pitch to everybody. You start with those that you think you want to work with the most. Then you work your way down. And you wait to see if anybody has the money and the foresight to see what you want to do. If we start with the best emotional affability first, creative affability.
Now, a lot's been said, and written about how B5 as a production changed how television shows are produced. You know, obviously the digital visual effects going to a widescreen aspect ratio, even things that people, the viewers don't see, like the Babylon contract for labor that you guys worked out. The five-year arc, with all that kind of acclaim, why is it that B5 isn't like a household name or an industry standard of how to do things? I mean, I say Babylon 5 to people, and I get this kind of blank look in their face.
Well, again, it all comes down to visibility. You know, we're not – their reaction is the correct reaction. We're not currently on the air. The DVDs sell to those who know the show. If you don't know the show, you're not that much inclined to purchase them. And that's been the case since roughly 2000. So, I have no problem with that reaction. It is the correct one. We did provide a change. And you hear from people who run the show. I know Damon Lindelof. He's a friend, works with J.J. Abrams and did Lost. And he said, when you create Lost, you want to do a Babylon 5 five-year arc. And he talked to Ron Moore over at Battlestar. Same thing. So that arc was really appealing to him. So it's getting where we are known, where we need to be known. And, we had the desired effect of kind of introducing that structure of the five-year arc and introducing, the widescreen thing. We were one of the very first shows to do that, first ones to really push an aggressive 5.1 sound mix, first ones to do virtual sets in television and CGI creatures. So we opened up a lot of doors, and to me, that's a happiness, because I get to see what others can do now to follow up on that. And that's the fun of it. When you create something, you want it to have an impact. And I think we did that with B5, and certainly with those who are making television now, they acknowledge it. Whether the person in the streets knows the show or not is less relevant to those who are making shows and say, yeah, we're hoping to do what you do with Babylon 5.
Well, that's pretty cool accolades at that point.
Does it make you sort of like feel like the proud grandfather to know that shows like people like Ron Moore and Joss Whedon got inspired to do story arcs and killing off main characters because of what you did?
I don't know if Joss did or not. We haven't talked about that. I've met him a few times. We've hung out a little bit here and there. But I think he had that in mind even before I came along. It may have helped him to get it going. But I'm not sure he was looking at the B5 model per se. And Joss is he's such a good writer on his own terms, and also a really nice guy. a bunch of us were having a dinner at my agent's house. Going over a bunch of business stuff as well, things that aren't worth repeating right now. And it was nighttime, and there's a trampoline in the backyard. And we're all sitting around talking, and at one point we notice that Joss is gone. And we're looking around, where the heck did Joss go? He was in the middle of this big conversation. And we hear from the backyard, spring. And all by himself in the dark, jumping on a trampoline, just couldn't be happier. And he's just a guy who is to writing as Tom Bombadil was to The Ring. He holds it, but doesn't have any power over it. And just a great, smart, creative guy on his own terms. So I think that, and Buffy's one of my favorite shows of all time. So I think that he probably had that in mind long before there was a B5 in existence, but we maybe have paved the road for him to be able to do it.
Huh. Well, here's a question that I know some people are curious about. In the introductions to the script books and some other places, you've given us a sense of what your childhood was like in broad strokes. So in terms of like character flaws that we see in Babylon 5 and other Straczynski writings, which ones emulate from yourself and which come from people that you've known in your lifetime?
Anything involving a person who's crummy at dating probably comes from me. Anything to do with addiction probably comes from my family. I come from, you know, four generations of felons, fools, drunks, and madmen. And alcoholism was heavy in my family. It's a Russian family, and you drink as you breathe. Which is why I don't touch the stuff. I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't do drugs, I don't gamble. I had the most boring personal life on the face of the planet. But so, in terms of Garibaldi's drinking, that has an origin in my growing up experiences. So a lot of it does come from my family and from myself. I try not to draw too much on just people on the outside because they can sue your ass.
Any similarities to people living or dead is merely coincidental, and don't you dare even think about calling a lawyer.
You betcha.
So in what ways then, when you were actually writing Babylon 5, how much of that reflected what was going on with you personally at that time?
It varied. Sometimes you're not aware of it while you're doing it. The thing about writing is you put yourself in a place where you're very still, and very quietly you hear this voice in the back of your head begin to whisper. And you have to be still enough to hear that, and then you begin writing as fast as you can to get it all down. And sometimes you're not aware until after the fact, to look back and go, oh, look, Sheridan was being torn apart by distraction and irritated by people around him and under a lot of pressure to produce something. That was me. You look back and go, oh, wait a second, that wasn't a telescope, that was a mirror. And so you only, not really, I try not to do it consciously because that way lies the road to self-indulgence. And I've always fought hard against self-indulgence. It may seem like an oxymoron, but I have. And whenever I would find myself doing it deliberately, I would delete it immediately because I thought that's, you know, there's no place for that. So I'm sure there was some of it here and there, and then more in retrospect than at the time. But yeah, there was certainly echoes of what I was going through year by year, season by season, to keep B5 on the air, just as Sheridan was keeping it, doing it to keep B5 in existence.
Sure.
Now, you had on the news groups put out a call for help for people to send you photographs of different places you had lived during your lifetime. What was the impetus, the inspiration for that project, and did you actually get it completed?
Completed, no. A lot of photographs will come in. That would be great for me. But here's the problem. I come from a lower class, if one is being uncharitable, lower middle class, if one is being charitable, background. And we moved a lot. In my first 17 years, we moved 21 times.
Wow.
I'm talking different cities, different towns, different neighborhoods, different states, from New Jersey to California to Texas to Illinois, on and on and on, 21 times 17 years. So there's, in memory looking back, there's kind of a blur for most of my childhood and going into adolescence. There's nothing to pin things onto. Usually if you go to the same place, you know, year after year, state-related learning says you will remember things more than if you're in some place once. And I would be in a new town for 6 months or less, and then boom, somewhere else. And when I turned 21, I asked my mother, she said, "Well, for your birthday, said, I want my past. I want you to write down on one piece of paper the addresses for everywhere where I lived. And even she didn't have all of them. She had most of them, but not all of them. And I've begun the process of writing an autobiography, which is strike hard to a number of people's consciences. And I wanted anchor points. I wanted to be able to look at something and try and remember what was going on at that time. And it was a huge help to me. The great irony being that constant moving, to a large degree, led to me being a writer. Because I fell in love at an early age with words for the following reason. I'd be on page, say, 16 of a Ray Bradbury novel in Matawan, New Jersey. And we'd move to, to Bourbonus, Illinois. And I go to the library and pick up the same book, same cover, and pick up 17 and begin reading. So words became my continuity. I didn't have a continuity of place. So I the fictional world became my continuity. It became where I lived. And words became stability to me. It became home. And that, I think, was a large measure of how I fell into writing, was the love of words. It's where I grew up.
So how did the molding of Joe Straczynski affect the relationships you had with the cast and the crew during the making of this? I mean, everybody we've talked to said, you know, the B5 crew, it was just like family. How much of that was built on how you grew up or created because of what you didn't have growing up?
I'm not a people person. I never acquired the skills to be a people person. You acquire those by making friends. And literally from the time I was born till the time I hit age 17, I didn't have friends. There was no time to make friends. The first time I ever went to the beach, we go with your friends and you burn logs in the fire and you do marshmallows and that kind of stuff. The first time I did that, I was 18. The second time was, well, never actually. So I've always been a lone wolf. Therefore, there is that part of you which longs to have what you never had and to create an environment that is pleasant for other people. And when I sat down with John Copeland and Doug to sort of say how we're going to structure this thing, I said, I want to work in a place where when you come to work, the number one sound you hear is laughter, where people are having a good time, and they hang out with each other, and they want to hang out with each other, and people stay. There's always a huge turnover in television. We kept 80% of our crew and keys through all 5 years, which is extraordinary. And we did it by, for instance, giving everyone a health plan. Even though we were shooting non-union, we gave everyone a health plan. We gave people vacation time. We would bring in, food for whoever wanted it there. When the fires were raging in L.A., we had trucks standing by to go in and rescue anyone who needed to be rescued. We had the earthquake. I said, screw the show for a while. Take the carpenters off. We'll shoot around the sets. Anyone who's had damage and needs to have their house worked on to make it livable, throw the carpenters in there. when they want to unionize, we went in there. We worked it out and didn't demonize the process. And it became, as a result, a family that would have been nice to have had growing up. And we would shoot, 5 days a week and end up on Friday. And usually when you shoot 5 days and you come to the end, the crew and the cast, they just split. They want to go off and get back to their lives. They would stay. We would wrap shooting at 6, 7 o'clock, and they would order in pizza, and they'd bring in some beers, and they would hang out in the parking lot right outside my window, by the way. And they would stay there until 10, 11 o'clock at night, just hanging out and talking and being friends. And the gossip that I heard through that window, oh, boy, stuff I didn't know, was going on. But they would, and they would go on vacations together. And of all the things that I did with B5, I'm almost proudest of the fact that we created a good environment to work in, which was, again, part of the trap of what made me want to stay there, keep that going, because it was extraordinary. And I'm sure you've heard of the members of the cast and crew, mm-hmm. and a lot of them really didn't know how good that environment was until they left and went elsewhere.
Right.
And it was, no one wanted to leave. And
yeah, at the end of the day. Bruce Boxleitner, when we've talked with him, that was one of the things he commented on, was telling all the other cast and crew to enjoy it while you were there, because this was so unlike any other show that he'd ever worked on.
Yeah, no, I share that with him. I mean, I've worked on shows before, and I try to learn from the mistakes of others, because mine are too multi-layered to learn from, because there's too many of them going on. And I saw how, you know, personally be control freaks and working on shows as a producer, I never even saw an editing room, you know, so they wanted to keep that to themselves, you know, therefore guaranteeing their own job security. Anyone who, and on that show, who wanted to sit in on a casting session, who wanted to sit in on the effects, who wanted to see how the editing works, anybody on that show, from to the guy who works the craft services table on up and down, was free to do so.
Snack man!
And I want that to be, you know, a salutary place to come to. And we've succeeded beyond our wildest expectations with that crew. It was they were a good bunch of guys.
Mm. And like I said, it's been repeated over and over. Every cast member, every crew member we've had on there just said, wow, I didn't know how good we had it until we worked on something else. And that's, you know, that's probably the biggest contribution to television I've ever heard anybody say. Just that, the fact that everybody said, this was the best thing I ever worked on. Just the creative environment, just working there was just the best thing. That's something.
And they all knew that anybody from the guy who sweeps the floor up and down to walk up to me and say, Joe, it sucks. And if they're right and can explain it, they get to stay. So no one had any fear of coming up to me and saying, I have a problem with something, I have a question about something. I encourage that. Although it's always very funny when, you know, they were shooting and I was even on set, and the director would say, you know, I need to talk to Joe, and you hear this chorus of microphones when you have to change, you know, someone wants to talk to Joe. Joe's coming down. something to poke down to the mast or something, you know. But and they all took responsibility for the show working. I mean, there was an actor I will not name, who came onto the show and did not know his line at all. And it was a role that required a lot of exposition. And I was looking at the dailies and just horrified by what I was seeing. And then we could edit around it to some extent, but it wasn't going to work. And I was going to go on to the set and have words with the actor, and I got pulled aside and said, Jerry Doyle, hold this actor. Because you're seeing it the next day. Pulled the actor behind the flats on the set. I had a conversation with him. This won't be a problem anymore.
Nice.
I got the impression he roughed him up a little. That's how serious they all were about getting the show done right. You know?
Nice. So going from the cast and crew relationships to the fan relationships, you probably had the very, very first, while in production, interaction with the fans as the show's going on. How did that come about? Was that someone asked you a question and you decided to ask it in a public forum? Or did you just decide, hey, sci-fi fans are on the internet, that's where I'm going?
Neither. What happened, I was on the nets long, long before B5. I was logging on to, remember the old BBSs you would get along?
Online? Yeah.
300 baud. Remember 300 baud?
Unfortunately, yes.
On a K-Pro 2 with 128K on a floppy disk. And I'll never need more than that.
I had a Lear Signer. I had a Lear Signer terminal.
Yep. So you know. So I was on, you know, Genie and all these little size bulletin boards for years before B5. And then when I sold B5, I had some other people who were producers saying, we have to get off the net now. I said, why? Well, you know, now you're this person over here. And I've never been terribly impressed with myself, because I have all the reason and knowledge in the world not to. I know all the reasons why I am stupid. And why should I change now? I'm on these bulletin boards and on these systems because I'm a fan. I like talking to other fans about science fiction. Why should I change that just because I'm working on a show? That was thought number one. Number two was, why not use this as an educational forum? Because there's a lot of stuff that happens in television that people don't understand why things are done the way that they are done. And I thought, if people understand the process, they'll have the tools they need to ask for better kinds of programs. You need to understand why things are done the way they're done. And wouldn't it be fun, if I was a fan back in the days of The Twilight Zone, the original, and Rod Serling was online every day talking about how they made The Twilight Zone, wouldn't that be freaking cool?
Wow.
Wouldn't I love that? Why not, if you feel that way as a fan, why not give that back to the fans who would appreciate about Babylon 5? I mean, I might fit to carry Rod's pencil box, but the theory is still there.
Right.
And, well, you know what? Let's do it. Let's take the bull by the horns, or any other orifice, and just do it. And I made the commitment to stay online and keep talking about the show, answering questions, even though I get the same question 100 times, you know, answer it as if it were the first time, and have a frank and open discussion about working on the show with the fans. And there were times it was crazy-making. There were times, you know, I got just incredible amounts of stalkers and abuse. I got Trojan horse viruses on my computer from Star Trek fans. literally.
Nice.
Wiped my hard drive out, one of them. And even though I'd be exhausted at the end of the day, but I would have 15 or 20 questions from fans and plus another 15 in the email, I would take the time to respond at length. Not one or two word replies. If you look at the ask and answer books, which I'm looking at with great horror, some of these are 16 paragraph replies to a two word question, yes? And then I would do all those, and I would address myself to the emails. And at conventions, you know, to this day, I see people who come up and say, I sent you an email privately years ago when you responded. And, you know, how great it would have been for me as a fan to have heard from someone I admired or liked, the writer or producer. So to me, that was always the trade-off. That was always not the obligation, but a sense of giving back to the fan community. It caused no end of grief on a number of occasions and misunderstandings and hassles that came out of it. But, you know, I wouldn't do it again. I would go through it again. I wouldn't do it a second time, but the first time was worth the doing.
Were there any ways in which that interaction online affected anything that you did on Babylon 5?
No. The problem is when someone says, you know, the fan consensus is, they're lying. Because you get 10 fans in a room, you have 12 opinions. There is no such thing as a fan consensus. Sometimes getting a question, a good question, would let me think more deeply about what I was replying about, and that could inform the show, because if someone, you know, asks more about Centauri culture, and I give a long explanation, and later on I have an episode where we're dealing with star culture, some part of that might come back to me. But in terms of giving direction to the show, I couldn't allow that because it would start diffusing the direction of the show. The only time it had a direct impact was when there was a fan who put forth a story idea that I had been thinking about, and I actually had written a good part of the script, and I had to torpedo the script until the fan would send a note saying, you know, I released this, and I know he was already in process. It took a year and a half before I finally felt legally comfortable to pursue that script.
So that only happened the one time?
That's correct. Because fortunately, and the online community is terrific. I mean, 99% of them are funny, rabbit, cute, and helpful, and they would, you know, if I said, don't give me story ideas, they would obey that. They would go along with it. And the cool thing was, often I'd be at a con giving a talk, and I'd say, those of you who are online, please don't repeat this. And son of a gun, they wouldn't. You know? we had, I know this is something you're preaching to the choir, but we had probably the best and the smartest group of fans I've ever seen. And that isn't just my opinion. When I was at Worldcon, you know, I was going to do a presentation in this one room. I think it was the first year we won the Hugo. And I looked at the room, and I knew it wasn't going to be big enough. I said to them, we're going to have a problem here. There's only seats, you know, 1,000 people. And I said, well, you know, you're not going to have more than 8% of the convention show up. I said, my people are coming. And the next day, I saw this huge line, And it was those who couldn't get in because the room was already full. We had to do two different presentations. And we had to wait like 4 hours before we could do the next group. And the convention organizer came up to me afterward and said, I got to tell you, you got the best fans in the world for the following reason. If this had been, and not this is not me saying this, this is him. He said, this had been a Star Wars crowd or a Star Trek crowd, and they couldn't get in. They were torn the joint apart. But to a person, not one of them got upset. And they all said, how can we help? What can we do? How can we make this work? And he said he'd never seen the like of it before or since.
Awesome. Yeah, I remember reading some of your more colorful posts way back in the day. I remember one during season 3 where you said, okay, I'm at my wit's end. You guys want to see the rest of season 3? Somebody sent me the cheat codes to Quake.
Which was true.
And I nearly spit my soda across my cubicle.
It was hideous. I couldn't get past this one level, and I had a script in front of me to write. And I said, shit. Someone give me the damn cheat codes. See, what I think they should make, when they make a game, is the comfy chair version of the game. I mean, the environments of these games are great. They're beautiful to look at. It's great action. And in the comfy chair mode, you get to the next level, and the demon brings you a nice comfy chair. And you sit in the comfy chair, and they fight each other. You get to watch them and see the beauty of the environment. Then they're done. They take the chair away. You go to the next level. I would buy that game tomorrow.
We've got, for the Wii, we have The Force Unleashed. And one of the things I like about it is, because I'm not an avid gamer, you can pretty much just swing the lightsaber Wiimote around and do as much damage as you would if you were doing all the button combinations.
Excellent.
Which frustrates my son to no end, because he's one of those that, you know, he's figured out all the combinations and I'm just flailing away. So, hey,
right.
One last question for you, Joe. What did you think of J.J. Abrams' take on Star Trek?
I enjoyed it. I thought he did all the right things. I think his reboot was correct. I think he did a great job on the casting. I think that the action level was there. I think that, I enjoyed it. I saw it twice. And I couldn't be more happy for the whole thing.
Do you still want to write Trek stories too?
Who knows what the future holds? But right now, you know, JJ's got that franchise well in hand, and I know that they're going to do a great job with the next one. And Lord knows there's enough film work in front of me right now to keep me busy on its own terms. So,
like Lensman.
Lensman, Forbidden Planet. Which I'm very excited about, which is going to be huge.
Yes.
The people that I'm working with on this are extraordinary, and it's going to be quite a film.
When Forbidden Planet gets to a point in production that you can talk about it, I definitely want to invite you on to Slice of Sci-Fi to talk about that.
It's going to be very cool. Very cool. And Ninja Assassin comes out in November, and there may be early screening, I've heard, at Comic-Con, possibly.
Ooh.
And there's two other things that are. I wish I could talk about them because your hair would ignite. But
we can save those for later. We are patient.
I don't have any hair to ignite.
It'd be a very small fire with me.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for indulging us. Thank you for joining us tonight. This has been a lot of fun for us. I hope our listeners also get a big kick out of this.
Cool. My pleasure to come, and thank you for the warm welcome.
Not a problem.
All right. Thank you very much, and you have a good evening.
All right, guys.
Wow, you guys rock. I'm
yeah,
like so all impressed.
All we had to do is say, hey, Joe, and then just kind of sit back.
Yeah, hearing all the stories, hearing additional information from stuff we had heard or read on the news groups over the years was just wonderful.
There are 10,000 listeners out there having geekgasms right now. You realize that?
Excellent.
We hope so. We hope so.
But we know that after the geekgasms are over, that comments will be flooding in. And so go ahead and call in those comments. You hopefully we'll be able to call in between phone calls when Gary's recording his messages.
Oh, Gary is going to have 10 billion comments.
We are going to have 100 different voicemails from Gary, each of them 10 minutes long.
Can we just get Gary his own number?
Please. He does have that number. What is that number, Summer?
That number is 206-338-2259. So go ahead, put that in your speed dial right now. Send in an email to BabylonPodcast@gmail.com if the line happens to be busy. But once again, 206-338-2259.
The year that the Great Maker talked with us yet another hour.
Feedback-a-palooza, Gary-palooza, Fan-a-palooza. Let's go.